lot of people are home this morning with their families, maybe. Or maybe they come in later, I don't know. What was? Okay. So, let's begin as we do usually with some meditation, calm our minds. Sit comfortably with your spine up and down straight. Relax your body. Relax your mind. Something that can help you relax your mind sometime is to just think of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. Whatever you have, you know, strange things in your life or worries, the Buddha of compassion is thinking of you, thinking of all sentient beings. And just begin by observing your breathing as we've done many times now. I think all of you have been here. You can add the added factor of trying to recall the number of breaths. Keep in mind the number of breaths that you're taking. So your mind is doing two things. It's watching whether you're breathing in or out and counting them successively. You know, the first inhalation, first exhalation, second inhalation, second exhalation. if you've been successful in calming the mind a bit, follow one of the breaths down to your heart chakra as though it goes up your nostrils to the crown of your head, down to the throat, down to your heart chakra. Just leave your attention in that region. Let go of attention to the breath, observing the breath, and instead observe the mind, the mental consciousness. As you've done several times this meditation, you begin to have a remembering consciousness of that clarity that can act as a starting point for watching the mind. Different thoughts may arise interfering with that sense of clarity, which is good. Recognize that although they are appearing as objects within that mind, they are the same entity of the mind. They are not mind, because the thoughts themselves don't perceive objects, but they are the nature of the mind. Just recognizing that, they can begin to dissolve back into the consciousness itself, because you're not feeding them, you're not following those thoughts or those images or focusing on them as objects. Let go of the appearance of your body to your mental consciousness. That's just a thought within the mind. It's not localized at one little spot within the mind, but maybe pervades the sense of the body. Try to perceive the consciousness itself, the subject mind to which the body is appearing, the subject mind which has this clarity and knowing as its nature. If your mind gets too tense, if you feel too drawn in, just relax the mind for a few moments. Sense that spaciousness, and again try to hold that with the factor of mindfulness. this clarity, spaciousness is not an object of I consciousness. And although you have the tendency to try to imagine it as something visual, rather it's something that you're knowing with a mental consciousness, this lack of obstructability. Besides not focusing on the body or the image of the body in the mind, let go of the sense of a person, a self, that is perceiving the mind, an observer. Whatever image you have of this clarity of the mind, recognize that is just a mental image as yet. We haven't penetrated to have a direct perception. And subtly let go of that, trying to perceive the subjective mind to which that is appearing. And within that calm, clear state of mind, recall that the very fact that we have a chance to meditate on this comes about because of our good fortune of having a life of leisure and endowment as a result of our past deeds in previous lives. And that this life of fortune is impermanent. We have to leave it eventually. And to make a resolution, a strong wish to make use of it this morning, today, this year, this life, to do some real healing that we've never done in numberless lives in the past. We may have begun. We've met the Buddhist path, the spiritual paths in the past, but we never brought them to any degree of completion so that we continued higher and higher over many lives. to heal ourselves so that we're less a problem for others, less a problem for ourselves, and to heal ourselves so that we become authentic beings, noble beings that take the welfare of others as more important than our own welfare. That's our goal in the distance, the attainment of enlightenment, not just for ourselves, but to be able to, as I said, to be a noble being that works for the welfare of all living beings, takes them into cognizance. Think for these reasons I'm going to participate this morning, listen to the talk, contemplate it, use my intellect to weigh what seems new, and to meditate on that which I've already developed some confidence in. Meditate means to keep it in mind. Once you've got the flavor of that, so we try to integrate the wisdoms of hearing, contemplation, and meditation. I'm going to do so in order to eventually become enlightened for the sake of all living beings. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. Was all of that noise a minute ago? Was the door stuck or? Car outside. Okay. Excuse me. I'm going to put a cough drop in here. So, how is everyone? You okay? Okay. This looks like the regular crew, the hardcore. Come here to chew the dry bones of the Buddhist tenets with courage. Thank you. So, we've been talking, we went over the Vaibhashika system, one of the two Hinayana schools of tenets. We're not quite finished with the Sautrantika. I'm going to finish this morning. Can you say Sautrantika? How is it spelled? Sautrantika. So like sutra, except the U of sutra has become kind of a diphthong, S-A-U, Sautrantika. So like sutra, the T-R-A. So they are the ones that, rather than accepting the seven treatises of the Abhidharma as the actual word of Buddha, they say that Abhidharma should be extracted from the sutras, because there are a lot of errors in these seven Abhidharma texts they claim that the Vaibhashikas accept, right? So, Sautrantikas, they're you could say there are two schools, two levels of Sautrantika. Those that are followers of scripture, and those who are followers of reasoning. We talked last time. Followers of scripture follow what scripture? The sutras? What is it? Abhidharma Kosha, which was written by Vasubandhu. So in some ways, they can't have arisen, if you consider that to be the definition, they can't have arisen before Vasubandhu, right? They were not from the very beginning that have that particular view, but they were, maybe there were Sautrantikas generally that were following the Mahavaibhasha, this great text, which Vasubandhu bases Abhidharma Kosha on. So you could say that they existed from the time of the Buddha. Then they're the followers of reasoning that base their view of the Sautrantika system on the Dharmakirti's texts and Dignaga's text on reasoning, Pramana. So I'll read a little bit from Jeffrey Hopkins' exposition in his big book, Meditation on Emptiness. Very good if you have that in your collection of books. It's very good reference. So the Sautrantikas following reasoning hold that the explicit objects of direct perception are impermanent objects. We talked a little bit about this in our low-rigga class. What does that mean? The explicit objects of direct perception are impermanent objects. Well, say, if you talk about direct perception of the eye, the explicit object of my eye consciousness might be the shapes and colors of this room. But indirectly or implicitly, I might recognize that there's no elephant in this room, right? It's not an explicit or direct, and not the obvious direct thing that I'm recognizing, but I can know it indirectly or implicitly. Same thing with mental consciousness. When we talked about the perception of selflessness for the Sautrantika, they say that what you are actually, in that meditative equipoise that realizes selflessness, you are explicitly realizing the impermanence of the five aggregates, right? That's the explicit or direct thing that you're knowing. Implicitly or indirectly, you're knowing that because you're directly knowing that they are impermanent, you are implicitly or indirectly knowing that they are lacking a permanent self. Right? So they say that the mind that realizes selflessness doesn't see selflessness directly. Why not? What would be the error in saying that the mind directly saw selflessness? Why does it have to be an implicit object? Well, just from the original statement, the explicit objects of direct perceptions are impermanent objects. What is selflessness? Is it impermanent? No, selflessness is a permanent phenomena. It's a non-affirming negation. Right? The upper tenets, Chittamatra, of the Mahayana tenets and the Majjhimaka school, say that it is possible for direct perception to know permanent phenomena explicitly. I mean, here also the lower tenets So Chandrika says it can know permanent phenomena, the mental consciousness, can know selflessness, but it doesn't know it directly because the permanence doesn't appear explicitly to it. It knows the permanence indirectly. I mean, it knows the permanence of the... It knows the lack of a permanent person indirectly. It's knowing directly the impermanence. That's what appears to it. Okay? So the Mahayanists, on the other hand, assert that permanent phenomena, a permanent phenomena such as emptiness, can be directly perceived. So that's a big difference here. So there, nowadays in Burma, one of my fellow monastics went and did a retreat there and studied, and the main emphasis is on trying to realize impermanence, subtle impermanence, so applied to your own self-being. So that's following that kind of school, and it's said that when you realize impermanence, you've realized selflessness. You know, explicitly you're realizing impermanence, implicitly you're realizing that there's no permanent self. Generally, we say that there is a subtler kind of selflessness for the Sautrantikas, right? Besides the lack of a permanent self, the lack of a self-supporting or substantially existent self. But that takes some more reasoning. Here they're mainly recognizing the aggregates, as though realizing impermanence is their ultimate realization. It's quite interesting. The Sautrantika's following reasoning explained that a yogi, in direct perception, explicitly realizes the impermanent mental and physical aggregates, the five aggregates, and implicitly realizes the permanent phenomenon of emptiness, which in their system is the non-existence of a person as a self-sufficient entity. And emptiness is thus not an ultimate truth, but an obscured truth. This for the Sautrantika, right? Because it is a truth for thought, appearing to the mind through the route of negation of a self-sufficient person. What are ultimate truths for Sautrantika? Do you remember? It's interesting because understanding the use of the words are different. These terms are different for the different tenets. KK, do you remember what an ultimate truth is for Sautrantika? Ultimate truths for Sautrantika are impermanent phenomena. Those are that are able to perform a function. Those things that are permanent don't perform a function, so they're considered to be conventional truths. A selflessness or an emptiness is a non-affirming negative or non-affirming negation, not implying anything in its place, and thus is permanent and cannot be seen directly for the Sautrantika. You can have a mental image of that, right? You can have a mental image of this selflessness. That mental image is itself said to be permanent. Are you knowing the self? Say, this is my hand is the mental image of the selflessness. The selflessness that you're thinking about is permanent phenomena. The mental image itself is said to be a permanent phenomena. So doesn't that appear directly to the conception? It's said to be its appearing object, but you're knowing the conceived object, that which the mental image is referring to, via the mental image. You're not actually looking at the mental image as though you're looking through the mental image. Remember, it's kind of like a pair of glasses through which you're looking at reality. So there's no contradiction there. The Satrantika emphasis on impermanent things is obvious. Impermanent objects are called ultimate truths, right? For Satrantika. What was ultimate truth for Vaibhashika? Impermanent things? That which the perception of which is not destroyed when either breaking into parts or when analyzing. So for them, for Vaibhashika, a pot, which is impermanent, is not an ultimate truth. Right? We would probably say that's true. For the Satrantika, a pot is an ultimate truth because it's impermanent. It's able to perform a function. For Vaibhashika, it's not an ultimate truth for not the reason that we would say in Majjhimaka. It's not an ultimate truth for Vaibhashika because the perception of a pot would be destroyed to your consciousness if you break the pot into pieces, if you crush it into pieces and you have a bunch of, you know, powder here. You wouldn't perceive pot. So Satrantika's emphasis on impermanent things is obvious. Impermanent objects are called ultimate truths, and yogis, in the most exalted of cognitions, explicitly realize not emptiness, they're not explicitly realizing emptiness, but the impermanent aggregates. If an object can perform the function of creating an effect, it is determined as ultimately existing. A pot, which for Vaibhashika and for Satrantika following scripture is a conventional truth, is an ultimate truth for the Satrantika's following Dharmakirti, the Satrantika's following reasoning. So there's a little bit of difference between the Satrantika's following scripture. They consider a pot to be not ultimately existing, but for the Satrantika's following reasoning, following Dharmakirti, it is an ultimate truth. So then another interesting tenet of the Satrantikas, sort of criticizing the Vaibhashikas. So in Abhidharma Kosha, when Vasubandhu was writing about the Vaibhashika tenets from the point of view of the Satrantikas, remember I mentioned that some of his sentences, statements would end with a particle that indicated like, oh, that's what the Vaibhashikas say, but kind of like sarcastically implying that's not what the Satrantika would believe. In the root text that one would memorize as a child, the Abhidharma Kosha, karikas. Karika means verses, right? So you would memorize that. It's not so clear. There's not an explanation. There's just that particle, grammatical particle at the end that leads to some doubt. But in the auto-commentary that Vasubandhu wrote to the Abhidharma Kosha, he explicitly explains why these certain assertions of the Vaibhashikas are incorrect. So he shows himself in the Abhidharma, in his auto-commentary, to be taking the Satrantika position. So one of the things that he's pointing out in the Vaibhashika is that the Vaibhashikas believe that impermanence, when we talk about impermanence, we talk about phenomena having a period of being created, a period of what comes after creation, abidance, you know, something, then a period of disintegration, and I'll read here. On the subject of impermanence itself, the Satrantikas offer a presentation that differs significantly from Vaibhashika and agrees with the Mahayana. I'm going to put this down a little. There we go.
see this a little bit better.
Yeah, thanks. The Vaibhashikas say that production, that's the creation, abiding, aging, and destruction, disintegration, are not four activities, but four agents. This is the Vaibhashika position. So when we talk about, you know, when we talk about the suffering of humans and so forth, I'm never quite, no, don't worry. I'm never quite satisfied with this. Get it up close. There we go. So when we talk about the suffering, the eight sufferings, a person, there's suffering of birth. What's the next one? Aging, sickness, and death. And then there's some other. These are the four great ones, right? That the Buddhists saw. So birth is like creation, or what is it called here? Production. Aging and death. Sickness is not one of these qualities of impermanence, right? So why do... When you talk about the four sufferings, why does aging come before sickness? Why not birth, sickness, aging, and death? Don't you get sick before you get aged? Why not? You were saying no. Yeah, from the Mahayana point of view, the very instant... You okay? You're aging. Okay, you're aging before my eyes. The very instant that you're born, you are aging. It's implicit in that very moment. For the Vaibhashikas, they're sequential things, and they are agents. So here the extra thing that when we talk about the four sufferings, the three in question are birth, aging, and death, but we're adding another one here. Production, abiding, aging, and death. So you can think of that, let's say in a person's life, you're born, you abide for some time, then you begin to age, and then you die. So the Vaibhashikas say that production, abiding, aging, and disintegration are not four activities, but four agents. That which causes production, that which causes aging, that which causes abiding, and that which causes disintegration. These four characteristics of impermanent phenomena are substantial entities separate from the phenomena themselves. They're substances. So the Vaibhashikas talk a lot about things having a substantial existence. And they are substances separate from the entity. For the other tenets, for the higher tenets, so Trantika and Mahayana, these are not something separate from the entities, but the very nature of the entities. These four characteristics of impermanent phenomena are substantial entities separate from the phenomena themselves. They are said to exist simultaneously as characteristics of one phenomenon, but to perform their functions serially, right, one after the other. According to the Vaibhashikas, the momentariness of impermanent things actually refers to the period of these four instants. So phenomena are said to be momentary or impermanent because of the sequence of these four instants. There's a period of creation that has been brought about by the agent, the substance of creation, a period of abidance. Once the thing is abided, has been created, then the next instant it abides. Then the next instant, the substance of aging takes place. And then there's a fourth instant when it, the thing that has been created is destroyed. Sounds like it takes a long time, say four instants. Both types of sautrantikas, however, hold, remember the sautrantikas don't hold this position. Neither the sautrantikas following scripture nor reasoning accept that. They hold that production is the new arising of what did not exist before. Abiding is the remaining of a type similar to what preceded it. Aging is the non-similarity in entity of a later moment and a former moment. Disintegration is a product not remaining a second moment after its present. So all four characteristics exist simultaneously. So that when something has been created, let's say one instant of mind, now my present instant of mind, gives rise to the next instant of mind, consciousness. That instant of mind has all four characteristics. It is created in that it's the production of something which did not exist before. See, the previous instant of mind was different than this instant of mind, right? This instant of mind is said to abide in that it is remaining as a type similar to what preceded it. It's similar to the previous instant. When we talk about a continuum, it's similar to what existed to what preceded it, but it is not identical to it. So it has been created. It is aging in that it is not similar to the next moment, the latter moment of consciousness. And it is disintegration in that it does not remain a second moment after its present. Products have a nature of momentary disintegration. It is not something that makes them so. So for the Vaibhashikas, phenomena are impermanent because there's something, the substance of these four stages of momentariness, they make them, say the substance of disintegration makes the phenomena disintegrate, makes it die, so to speak. For the sautrantikas and above, all of these four moments all of these four qualities take place in one moment. So the moment that you're born, you're also aging. So when you refer to the four sufferings, right, leaving out, you know, you talk about birth, aging, sickness, and death, because you're aging immediately upon the first instant of birth. In the 12 links, what we were talking about the other day, one of the links is called aging and death, right? Actually, it's called death with or without aging. Remember one of the earlier ones had a similar kind of phrasing? What was the earlier one? Name with or without form, right? Because you could be born in the formless realm. So here, death with or without aging means sometimes a person can be born one instant and not exist a second instant after that. From the Prasangika point of view, from these higher tenets, you would say even that first instant is aging. So all products last only the instant of their production. There's not these four instants of being created, abiding, aging, and then being destroyed, as the Vaibhashikas hold, but just one instant has all four qualities in it. Products have a nature... All products last only the instant of their production. They require no further cause for their disintegration than their own production. Being produced is the very cause of the next instant changing, being destroyed, disintegrating. Does it make sense? Subtle? Maybe not, I don't know. So of the two schools of the Sautrantikas, the Sautrantikas following scripture don't talk about self-consciousness. Remember what self-consciousness was? Self-knowing was an entity of consciousness that was aware of knowing. It's not a mind in general is the subject of its objects. So you're knowing an object. Self-consciousness is it from the point of view of the Sautrantikas that follow reasoning and the Chittamatrans is an entity of the consciousness that is knowing that you are knowing. Okay, the Sautrantikas following reasoning also differ from the Vaibhashikas in that they assert self-consciousness, self-knowing. Self-consciousness is here not introspection or self-awareness, you know, like, you know, thinking about yourself or something like that, but a consciousness's cognizance of itself non-dualistically, much as the sun illumines itself while it illuminates others. In this context, self-consciousness has little function in the spiritual path, and despite its somewhat impressive name, does not occupy even a degree of importance that elicits a clear position from each school. So not every school even talks about, brings up the subject of self-consciousness or self-knowing, but it's very important in the Chittamatra school that we're going to be talking about next, the first of the Mahayana schools, self-knowing, self-knowing consciousness. So just at the end, if you were to give a definition of a Vaibhashika, is a Hinayana proponent of tenets, so it's not a Mahayana school, that does not assert self-consciousness, but who asserts the true existence of external objects with some qualifications. Okay, so now we're going to get to the first of the Mahayana schools. So you know, after the Buddha passed away, we believe that the Buddha taught Mahayana sutras during his lifetime, as he taught also Hinayana sutras, the four turnings of the wheel, three turnings of the wheel. But after the Buddha passed away, the Mahayana teachings became less prominent as the Hinayana teachings were very well practiced. In fact, for a long period of time, for several hundred years after the Buddha passed away, it was only the Bodhisattvas that practiced, didn't propagate the teachings very extensively, maybe because of the popularity of the Hinayana teachings. And it wasn't until the time of Nargajuna, several hundred years after the passing of Buddha, and the teachings of Asanga also around that time, a little after Nargajuna, or around the same time as Nargajuna, that the Mahayana teachings were again propounded in the world. Of the two, Nargajuna mainly opened and introduced into the world the Buddha's teachings on the middle way, the Majjhimaka, right? Asanga, who had the fortune to see Maitreya, He did this long retreat we were talking about. He did a 12-year retreat. Remember? Breaking every 3 years, giving up frustratingly, and then having some vision that he thought, oh, I can do this. He went back into retreat to try to see Maitreya. He wanted to ask Maitreya questions to revivify the Mahayana in the world. That was one of the reasons his mother had these two children. She was a proponent of the Mahayana. She was bemoaning the lack of the prominence of the Mahayana in the world, and she had these two sons from two different fathers to try to bring back the Mahayana. One of her sons was Vasubandhu, who eventually became a Mahayanist. The other son was a Sangha who sought out a direct communication with Maitreya to get the right answers, how to popularize the Mahayana again. So he, a Sangha mainly, the texts that he received from Maitreya into Shita Heaven were mainly talking about the Chittamatra school or the Yogacara school, can be called both. Although some of the texts, how many texts did he receive from Maitreya, do you know? There are five great texts that he received. Some of them maybe are talking from the, if you look closely, they're talking about some of the Majjhimaka schools, but they can all be interpreted to a certain degree from the Chittamatra point of view. Some of them also, their final view, like the Uttara Tantra, is actually Prasangika Majjhimaka, but all can be interpreted from the Chittamatra point of view. So the Chittamatra, from the point of view of the levels of sophistication, is considered to be a little bit lower in sophistication than the Majjhimaka school. Although from the Chittamatra point of view, it's considered superior, right? So what does Chittamatra mean? Is it Chittamantra or Chittamatra? By the way, like mantra or matra? I think, you don't know? I think we said before, right? Chitta mantra, the mantra of the mind? No. It's a different word. Matra. M-A-T-R-A. Not mantra. Not M-A-N-T-R-A. Matra. Matra means mere or only. So it's mere mind or mind-only school. The Chittamatrans, or Chittamatra, mind-only school, are so-called because they assert that all phenomena are the nature or entity of the mind. There's just mind, in other words. There's only mind. So what does that mean? Does that mean that there are no objects other than the mind? This is, everything is mind. If this were mind, this would be a subject, right? What are the qualities of mind? To be clear and knowing, right? This glass, my eyeglass case, would have to be a subject that knows objects. So phenomena are not, objects. The things that we usually think of that are different than the mind, they are not mind itself, but they are the entity of the mind, the nature of the mind. It's a subtle distinction. What does that mean? From the point of view of the Chittamatra, our consciousness, which is like this is the main thing, there's only mind, our consciousness has within it seeds, karmic seeds, you can say, to experience different things, to experience, let's say, the perception of my eyeglasses, or say my rosary. When that seed ripens, it ripens into two different things at the same time, simultaneously. The object and the consciousness that perceives, that has the perception of that object. So one seed on the consciousness, when it ripens in the subject's consciousness and the object that it is cognizing. So that means that the consciousness and the object that it's perceiving are of the same entity, but still the object is not considered a consciousness. What is the consciousness? It's the part of the seed which is a subject that is knowing the object. Does that make this sound reasonable? So one seed on the consciousness, when it ripens, one part of it gives birth to the subjective quality of mind, and the other part of the seed arises as what it is knowing. So subject and object are empty or devoid of being different entities. KK, I can see the wheels turning. Okay. So here is where the word emptiness comes into the Chittamatra. Generally in the Hinayana tenets, we don't talk so much about emptiness. Now in the Mahayana tenets, the first of the Mahayana tenets, the Chittamatra, the lower tenets mainly talk about selflessness. They use the word empty, not so much emptiness. Here now in the Mahayana tenets, we're talking about emptiness. And this is sort of the first presentation of emptiness from the Mahayana point of view. It's talking about the fact that outer phenomena, are empty in a certain sense. They are empty in that they are devoid of being what they appear. What do they appear? They appear to be external to the mind. They appear to be different entities than the mind. Right? This my iPad here appears to be something. You know, my eye consciousness seems to be the subject that's up here in my body and my eye faculty. The iPad appears to be something, a different entity than the consciousness. For the Chittamatra, my perception, my consciousness that perceives the iPad, my eye consciousness, and the iPad that it's perceiving have both arisen from one imprint on my consciousness. And they arise simultaneously, which is one of the criticisms of the Prasangika is going to have of that system. Usually cause and effect, I say usually, cause and effect are not simultaneous, right? What comes first? Effects come first, right? Then there are causes? No. Causes always precede effects, right? For the Chittamatra and some other, you know, some interpretations of lower schools, you can have, for the Vaibhashika also, you can have simultaneous cause and effect. In fact, one of the causes in the Vaibhashika system is the simultaneously acting cause. Its effect is simultaneous. So here the Chittamatras are saying, so between the eye consciousness that perceives the iPad and the iPad itself, one is the subject, one is the object, right? Which is the cause and which is the effect? Even Chittamatra would say one is the cause and one is the effect. What do you think? What? The object is the cause and the consciousness is the effect, right? But for the Chittamatra, those two are simultaneous. Whereas for other tenets, most other tenets, the consciousness arises a subsequent moment to the object itself. Right? There is the one instant of the object that is the cause, and the consciousness of that object rises the next instant. Let's say if I have a continuity of eye consciousness of this, there's one instant of consciousness of it. I'm just talking about the subject. One instant of consciousness, the next instant of consciousness, the next instant of consciousness, you know, succession of moments of consciousness. But each moment of consciousness, from the higher point of view, always is arisen from the previous moment of the object. So the consciousness of moment two has arisen from its cause, the object of moment one. The object of moment two is perceived by the consciousness of moment three, so forth. Does that make sense? Yeah. Too complicated? No, okay. So the upper tenets say that. The Chittamatra, I say the Majjhimaka schools and some of the people who criticize this particular interpretation of the Chittamatra. The Chittamatrans would reply that that to have cause and effect, to have a consciousness of an object of a previous moment, contradicts the sense of having a direct perception, let's say of a fresh perception, because you're knowing something of the previous moment. But the higher tenets say that that's not contradictory, that it is, when you have a direct perception, the fact that there's no intervening moment between the object of one moment and the consciousness of it means it's a direct perception. They don't have to be simultaneous. There's no intervening moment. You know, there's no like gap between the object, which is the cause of consciousness, and the consciousness. The consciousness arises the next moment. So for the Majjhimaka and the higher tenets, for the Majjhimaka and higher tenets, there is a cause and effect. Cause precedes the effect. But for the Chittamatra, the cause and the effect are simultaneous. And they say, that's good, because that shows it's a direct perception. You're knowing what's happening right there. So that's what the Buddha meant when he's talking about direct perception. That's what the Chittamatrans are saying. The Chittamatra, mind only, are so called because they assert that all phenomena are of the nature or entity of the mind. There's other names too. They're also called Vijnanavadin. Do you know what Vijnana means? Sanskrit word? Vijnana is another name for citta. So Vijnana is in Tibetan namshe. Citta is sem. So there's several synonyms for mind. So they're also called Vijnana Vadins and some other names. They're also called, generally, they're also called Yogacara, but that'll come. Have you heard that name, Yogacara school? Generally, that's referring to Chittamatra. So they assert that all phenomena are of the same nature or entity of the mind. This is not the same as asserting that all phenomena are mind, right? We said, because minds are observers of objects, right? Minds are subjects that are defined to have their objects. So if all phenomena were minds, stones and, you know, cups and so forth, which are objects, would absurdly have objects of observation. They would know things. Rather, what they mean is that just as in a dream, objects are not the mind that perceives them, but are also not separate entities from the mind. Right? So when you think about something, when you have a dream, this is one of the examples that the Chittamatrans use very much to talk about why mind only is legitimate. They use the example of a dream. When you have a clear dream, the objects of your dream, are they consciousness? No, they're the entity of your consciousness, and your consciousness is imagining that it is experiencing them, right? They're coming, in a sense, in a dream. They use that to also explain how the dream object and the consciousness perceiving it are coming from one imprint on the mind. So the objects in a dream are not the mind that perceives them, but they are also not separate entities from the mind. There's no separate. If you dream of being chased by wild dogs in your dream, or you dream of the best tasting durian that you've ever imagined, that durian doesn't exist as a separate object from the mind. It's not mind itself, but it's not a separate object that later you can say, oh, I dreamt of it, here it is. So the objects of the world for the Chittamatra are not the consciousnesses that perceive them, but are also not separate entities from those consciousnesses. They're the same entity as the consciousness. So there's this where the word emptiness comes in. Phenomena, objects, and the consciousnesses that perceive them are empty of being different entities. So that's the sense of the word emptiness for the Chittamatra. Does that make sense? Empty of being different entities. One of the phrases is often comes, blue, the color blue, let's say a patch of blue that you see, and the blue apprehending eye consciousness, the conscious eye consciousness that apprehends blue, are empty of being different entities. Another name for Chittamatra is Yogacara, because they arrange the practices of the path from the viewpoint of yoga. All Buddhist tenets are propounded for the sake of practice, yoga practice, so it's not a perfect definition. So there are two kinds of Chittamatrans, just like there were for the Sautrantikas, and also, were there for Vaibhashikas also? Were there two kinds of Vaibhashikas? Just generally one kind of. There were 18 schools, but there weren't two kinds of schools. For the Sautrantikas, we said there were Sautrantikas following scripture and Sautrantikas following reasoning, right? The followers of scripture followed what? The Abhidharma Kosha. And the followers of reasoning followed Dignaga and Dharmakirti, the texts on reasoning, logic. Here for Chittamatra, there's also two schools, the followers of scripture and the followers of reasoning. Here, the followers of reasoning also depend on Dharmakirti and Dignaga, on the Pramana literature. But the followers of scripture are not depending on Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, but they're depending on his brother's texts. The five treatises that Asanga received from Maitreya in Tushita Heaven. Did you know that? Followers of scripture? The followers of scripture are mainly those who follow Asanga's five treatises on the levels. That means the levels of the hearers' practice, the various what we call the Shravaka Bhumi. Shravaka Bhumi is the name of a text that talks about the various levels of the Shravaka path. And then there's another text called the Bodhisattva Bhumi. Or you could, in English, you'd put an S on the end, right? Because plural, Bodhisattva Bhumis. And the followers of reasoning are those who follow Dignaga's compendium of valid cognition, the Pramana Samuchaya, and Dharmakirti's seven treatises on valid cognition, among which is the Pramana Vartika, the text that usually the monks and nuns study in the monastic tradition. Though in general, the term Chittamatra refers to the followers of scripture. So when a Sangha came back from Tushita's heaven, he began to propound this system that Maitreya had laid out for him in these five treatises, mainly called Chittamatra. Though in general the term Chittamatra refers to the followers of scripture, that is, the followers of a sangha, still the followers of reasoning are said to be more advanced of the two groups. So sometimes the followers of reasoning may be more like Yogacara. The name Yogacara is used. This is because a sangha teaches that there are three final vehicles. So what does that mean? In Singapore, what are the three final vehicles? I think what? It's got to be what? Mercedes, BMW, and what's the third one? Joking. What? Lexus. No, when we talk about vehicles in the in Buddhism, we talk about the Hinayana and the Mahayana. Yana means vehicle, that which brings you to a destination, just as a BMW brings you to a destination. Three final vehicles, what does that mean? Or three vehicles, what are the three vehicles? Generally, we said Hinayana and Mahayana, but actually, if you break up the Hinayana, the Buddha actually taught amongst the practitioners of the Hinayana, there are two kinds of practitioners. The Shravakas, that are mainly following, that are listening to the Buddha's teachings and are realizing them, and then they later proclaim to others that they've realized that path. They're called the Shravakas. And then there are the Pratika Buddhas, the self-realizers who don't like to be in their subsequent rebirths. They don't want to be in the world when the Buddhas are there teaching. They want to do it by themselves. So there is the Shravaka Yana and the Pratika Buddha Yana, two vehicles, the vehicle of the hearers, the vehicle of the Pratika Buddhas, and the third vehicle is the vehicle of the Bodhisattvas. So for some schools, there are three different final destinations that those vehicles bring you to. The Shravaka Yana brings you to the Shravaka Nirvana. The Pratika Buddha Yana, or the Pratika Buddha vehicle, brings you to a different kind of nirvana. Why is that? Different. Say, when a Pratika Buddha reaches nirvana, they're still alive, right? They haven't passed away into parinirvana. They have greater realization than a hearer who had through their vehicle had attained nirvana. Why is that? Yeah. What? They've accumulated merit over a greater length of time, and they've also taken a more subtle understanding of cyclic existence. The 12 links is their major object of investigation. The hearers mainly take the Four Noble Truths as their matrix, you know, what they're trying to understand. The Pratika Buddhas understand the Four Noble Truths, of course, but they go into more detail on the evolution of cyclic existence and phenomena through understanding the 12 links of dependent origination and accumulate over a longer period of time, maybe eons, a greater amount of merit. So when they reach their state of Pratika Buddhahood, they have greater clairvoyance, greater powers, and more magnificence than the Hinayana arhats, than the Shravaka arhats. So it's considered to be a different destination, a different final vehicle. So the Pratika Buddha vehicle brings them to a different destination than the vehicle of the hearers that brings them to the ordinary nirvana. How about the Bodhisattva Yana? What destination does that bring them to? The Bodhisattva Nirvana? No, we don't say that. We say it brings them to Buddhahood, to enlightenment, right? So from one point of view, we can talk about three destinations. The Shravaka Nirvana, the Pratika Buddha Nirvana, and enlightenment. All of them exist. Say the Buddha had much more magnificence and omniscience had total omniscience compared to the Pratika Buddhas. Pratika Buddhas don't have omniscience. They have greater clairvoyance than the hearers, but they have nowhere near the powers of an actual Buddha, the omniscient Buddha. So Asanga teaches that there are three final vehicles, Asanga's texts that he brought back from Tushita Heaven. Generally, the Sautrantikas and the Vaibhashikas are not talking so much about this. They say generally that there are two vehicles for most people, the vehicle of the hearer and the vehicle of the Pratika Buddha, because they are different kinds of final experiences. They don't talk so much about the Bodhisattva vehicle, although you can see implicit in the Hinayana teachings that they accept a Bodhisattva path, but they don't talk about so much as a Bodhisattva vehicle, because they say this is a rare person who follows that Bodhisattva path to become enlightened. So Asanga says there are three final vehicles, meaning that some sentient beings never achieve Buddhahood because their vehicle is completed at a lower stage on which they remain forever. So when the Shravaka reaches for Asanga, or let's say, it's not necessarily Asanga's view, he's mirroring and teaching in the world what Maitreya had set out for him to present this Chittamatra school from a point of view of a stepping stone to better understand the Majjhimaka. Okay. So he's presenting this not as his own idea. In fact, Asanga is said to have, his final viewpoint was actually Prajnagika, Majjhimaka. But he's presenting this mirroring his teacher Asanga, his teacher Maitreya, who is presenting this system as a skillful means to lead sentient beings higher. So some sentient beings are destined from the beginning. Their lineage is, they're of definite lineage that they will end up in the hearer path and they will achieve the hearer's nirvana. And that's their, they will never, they're, you know, nothing else other than that. Some will end up in the Pratika Buddha nirvana and they will never change from that. Some will follow the Bodhisattva path and achieve enlightenment. According to Asanga, some hearers only realize that a person... Okay, so what's the difference between them? From Asanga's point of view, the hearers realize that a person is empty of being self-supporting, substantially existent, which was, from the earlier tenets, the subtler kind of selflessness. They never realize this Chittamatra sense of emptiness. What's the Chittamatra sense of emptiness? An emptiness of objects and subjects being different entities. Say the fact that a patch of blue and the eye consciousness that perceives it are empty of being different entities, that they are arising from one potential upon the consciousness. That's considered to be more subtle than realizing the selflessness of persons. According to the Sangha, some hearers only realize that a person is not a self-sufficient person, not a self-sufficient entity, and they never realize that objects and subjects are empty of being separate entities. These hearers aim only toward a solitary peace. Not in the sense of solitary realizer, but just solitary in the sense of not taking other sentient beings into consideration. Right? Self-cherishing. The Chittamatra followers of Dharmakirti, however, point to the impermanence of the obstructions, the fetters, and to the skill of the Buddha in teaching, and thereby show logically that eventually everyone cognizes both selflessnesses, the selflessness of person and the selflessness of phenomena. So here the Chittimatrans are introducing this new terminology. Selflessness of persons means the lack of a self-supporting, substantially existent person. The selflessness of phenomena means the lack of a difference in entity between a subject and an object that it's perceiving. Right? One is said to be more subtle. So for the Chittimatras who are followers of scripture, following a Sangha, they say that there are three final vehicles that some people never realize: the selflessness of phenomena, the hearers. Whereas the followers of reasoning say that everyone, because of the skill of the Buddha's teachings and because the obstructions themselves are impermanent, that everyone eventually realizes the selflessness of phenomena, and that there is one final vehicle, that even the Hinayana arhats will be awakened by the Buddha eventually, and they will achieve enlightenment. They will realize the selflessness of phenomena. Right? Ekayana is called. Eka means what, do you know? In Sanskrit? Eka means one. So ekayana means one vehicle. So that is referring to one final vehicle. So for the generally, from the Chittimatras following reasoning and above, everyone will eventually become enlightened. But for the Chittimatrans following scripture, there are three final vehicles. You're sort of caught in one of those vehicles. Does it make sense? Oh, good. Okay. Roger, you have to nod also. Okay, good. Even if you don't understand. The Sautrantikas following reasoning. Remember, the Sautrantikas following reasoning also depended on Dharmakirti's texts, and the Chittimatrans following reasoning also accept Dharmakirti. But for the Sautrantikas, they don't accept one final vehicle. They accept that hearers have their own final destination, Pratika Buddhas have their own final destination, and implicitly they accept that the bodhisattvas end up as Buddhas that are a different destination. So the Sautrantikas following reasoning interpret Dharmakirti's teachings differently than the Yogacharas, the Chittimatrans, and they accept three final vehicles, the Sautrantikas following reasoning, with only one type of realization of selflessness. So there's a difference. So for the Sautrantikas following reasoning, you following? Joy's got her eyes closed. You're concentrating, right? Or you're daydreaming? The Sautrantikas following reasoning, that are following Dharmakirti, they say that there are three final vehicles, but not for the same reason that the Chittimatrans following reasoning say there are three final vehicles. Chittimatrans following reasoning say that there are three different levels of sophistication of realization. The hearers realize the selflessness of persons. The bodhisattvas realize the emptiness. Bodhisattvas also realize the selflessness of persons, but they realize the emptiness for them, emptiness of subject and object being different entities, right? Maybe Pratika Buddhas have a somewhat more sophisticated realization than the hearers. I can't remember. Maybe he's coming here. But for the Sautrantikas following reasoning, they also say there are three follow. The Sautrantikas following reasoning say there are three final vehicles. Am I getting confused here? The Sautrantikas following reasoning say there are three final vehicles because the three individuals, the hearers, solitary realizers, and Buddhas, accumulate merit for different lengths of time. They all realize the same selflessness of persons. So I think I made an error there in saying, so the Chittamatrans following reasoning say that there are three vehicles and three kinds of realizations, but they say there is one final vehicle, right? Because eventually everyone will realize the selflessness of phenomena in addition to the selflessness of persons. I think I said that they said there were three final vehicles. So the Sautrantikas following reasoning interpret Dharmakirti's teachings and accept three final vehicles, but with one type of realization of selflessness. They say that you just realize the selflessness of a self-supporting, substantially existent person. In both Chittamatra schools, however, there are different types of selflessness which vary in difficulty of realization, in that it is more difficult to realize that objects and subjects are empty of being separate entities than to realize that a person is not a self-sufficient, self-supporting entity. Thus, there are two types of selflessness, one of phenomena in general and one of persons, that are different. How are you doing? Are you getting a headache? Okay. This is something that if you were to study tenets, you'd go slowly over. We're doing a crash course, right? Yeah. It's a crash. I hope your mind has not. Just reboot. If your mind crashes, just reboot, okay? Unplug. Plug back in, reboot, let the operating system come up again. So, for the Hinayana tenets, although there is said to be a gross selflessness of persons and a subtle selflessness of persons, they don't talk about selflessness of phenomena. Remember, the gross selflessness of persons is what? The person's lack of being permanent, partless, and independent. Kind of a refutation of the Vedic view of a person, a soul, of an Atma, that was permanent, partless, and independent. That's said to be the gross selflessness of persons. Subtle selflessness of persons is something more subtle, in that the person is understood to be devoid of being as it appears to oneself, as being self-sufficient and substantially existent. It is not a real substance. There's not a substance of a person for the lower tenets. Substance, a substantially existent phenomena, means one that is not merely imputed by the mind. Like, for instance, the rosary, you can't perceive an imputed phenomena for the lower tenets, like a rosary, without perceiving its basis of designation, the beads. A substantial entity is one that can be perceived by its very substance, like a tree. You can perceive a tree directly, it's substantially existent, but a forest is something that's imputed upon a collection of trees. It's something that you know by perceiving the basis upon which you impute that name, forest. Or an army is said to be imputedly existent. It's something that you know by perceiving the individual members of the army, the cavalry, the soldiers, and so forth. So they talk about these two levels of selflessness, but they don't talk, and they're both talking about selflessness of person in the Hinayana. Indirectly, they talk about a selflessness of phenomena, but in a funny kind of way. They say that this water is empty of being an object of enjoyment of a self-supporting, substantially existent person. Okay, for those who are listening on a tape, I just drank some of the water. So the Chittamatrans, though, talk about not only emptiness of phenomena, emptiness of persons, which they take to be the emptiness of a self-supporting, substantially existent person, but they talk about the emptiness of phenomena. The Chittamatras that follow scripture are the only Buddhist school to accept 8 consciousnesses. So this is important to know, because I think in one of the classes someone said, when we talked about the 6 consciousnesses, remember the 6 consciousnesses? Generally the 5 senses and the mental consciousness. The 6th consciousness, I think my tongue, yesterday at dinner, someone gave me something called Nu, was it Num? This Mala, Ma. So it was Mala soup that numbs your tongue. I think that's why I can't speak that. You all know what I'm talking about, right? So if you're watching this on the video on YouTube or whatever, or on Facebook, or if you're listening to the tape, you won't, in some other country, you won't understand. There's some kind of peppercorn that numbs the tongue. It's a little bit like what Lama Zopa and the Sherpas like, grows up in Solukhumbu, the Erma herb sort of numbs the tongue. So I'm wondering if that's why I'm having trouble speaking this morning. I'm saying, Sautrantikas following scripture. I can get out. The Chittamatras that follow scripture are the only Buddhist school to accept 8 consciousnesses. Okay, so generally we talk about 6 consciousnesses, and the 6th consciousness is not some mystical thing, it's the mental consciousness, right? But the Chittamatrans affirm that there are 2 other consciousnesses. One with a very famous name, the Alaya Vijnana. Have you heard of that? Alaya Vijnana? Vijnana was this word I mentioned before, Namparshepa, that means consciousness. The Alaya means storehouse or foundation consciousness. The Chittamatrans say that in addition to the 5 consciousnesses, in addition to the 6 consciousnesses, there's a 7th consciousness called Alaya Vijnana, upon which the karmic seeds are deposited. It has other functions also. And there's an 8th consciousness called the afflicted consciousness, afflicted with self-grasping. So the Alaya Vijnana is sometimes called mind basis of all, or the foundation consciousness. The followers of reasoning, the Chittamatra followers of reasoning that follow Dharmakirti and Dignaga, and all the other Buddhist tenets, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Majjhimaka, only assert 6 consciousnesses, with some of the functions of this 7th and 8th consciousness being performed by the mental consciousness. So I think in one of our classes someone asked about these 8 consciousnesses. Weren't there more than 6 consciousnesses? So generally, that particular view is held only by the Chittamatra followers of what? What? Reasoning? What? Scripture. Okay. Putting words in your mouth. Okay. So you could give a definition of Chittamatra. A Chittamatran, we put sort of English case ending on the end, Chittamatran. It's not Sanskrit, right? Chittamatra. A follower of Chittamatra is a person propounding Buddhist tenets who uses reasoning to refute external objects. Right? There are no objects external to the mind. And who asserts that dependent phenomena such as consciousness truly exists. Generally, the Vaibhashika and the Sautrantika say that phenomena truly exist, right? And here, for Chittamatra also, they say, there's sort of like kind of like halfway between the Hinayana tenets and the Majjhimaka, because they say that ultimately the consciousness truly exists, and that phenomena other than the mind are empty of being different entities from the mind. So they have a lesser... in a certain sense, they don't exist in the same way that the mind does. Phenomena, outer phenomena like the cup or my glasses, appear to be external from the mind, but that's an illusion. They're empty of being different entities from the mind. So this sense of chittamatra, mind only, is the very core of the Chittamatran teachings. In fact, the Buddha taught in different sutras everything. There's a very famous phrase, I think, in the Lankavatara Sutra. You know, have you heard of the Lankavatara Sutra? What does that mean, Lankavatara? Something to do with the deity Tara? Lankavatara means the descent to Lanka, which was what? Sri Lanka, right? When some incident in that. And in that sutra, very famous sutra, Mahayana Sutra, right? And one of the famous statements in that is, all three realms are mind only. All three realms. What are the three realms? Usually we say desire realm, form realm, formless realm. Can mean other things, but you generally like that. All three realms, everything in samsara, are mind only, are chitta matra. So Buddha actually said this. But that's a basis. When Maitreya composed these texts that Asanga brought back, when he's propounding this system, that's one of the statements that is used. You know, this is what the Buddha Shakyamuni said. He said that all three realms are mind only, and that means that the phenomena of the three realms are not different entities from the consciousnesses that are perceiving them. There's some imprint, some potential upon a mind that gives rise to both the subject mind simultaneous with the object that it perceives, that there's no difference in entity between the two. Okay? It means that there are no objects which are entities external to the perceiving consciousnesses. The Chittamatrans say they and the Yogacara Svatantrikas, okay, so we're going to get a little ahead of ourselves here. The Chittamatras, two main parts, those following scripture and those following reasoning. When we talk about the Majjhimaka school, which is coming next, generally there are two schools, the Svatantrika Majjhimaka, my mala, what was it, mala?
Mala.
My mala, my tongue is allowing me to say that now. The Svatantrika Majjhimaka and the Prasangika Majjhimaka, right? Two main schools. Even the Svatantrika Majjhimaka is divided. There's the Sautrantika Svatantrika Majjhimaka. That's the lesser of the Svatantrika schools. And there's the Yogacara Svatantrikas. Yogacara Svatantrika Majjhimaka. So the Chittamatrans have a similarity with the Yogacara Svatantrikas. They're generally not called Chittamatra Svatantrikas, they're called Yogacara, but it's referring to this similar idea. They are the only Buddhist schools which assert that there are no external objects. Well, there's the subtlety here. You can't say they don't say there are external objects. Even for Chittamatra, Chittamatra says these pair of glasses, this cup, are external objects. But they are not external objects that are a different entity from the consciousness. What does that mean? If they say there are external objects, what are internal objects? Well, internal objects are the different phenomena of the mind, right? We talk about external to the mind and external to the mind. Internal to the mind, external to the mind. But here, the Chittamatrans and the Yogacara Svatantrikas are the only schools that assert mind only conventionally. They say that mind only, citta matra, exists conventionally. They are the only Buddhist schools that assert that there are no external objects, a different entity from the mind. All the other schools, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Sautantrika, Svatantrika, and Prasangika, all assert that objects of a sense consciousness are entities external to the perceiving consciousness. So from Prasangika point of view, there are external objects. They don't exist inherently, but they do exist in external to the mind as different entities from the mind. For the Chittamatrans and the Yogacharasvatantrikas, phenomena are the same entity as the mind. They are not existing as external objects as they appear to be different entities from the mind. They'd still use that distinction. I remember Geshe Zopo explaining to us when he was teaching Lama Tsongkhapa's famous text on the interpretive and the definitive interpretive understanding of the sutras, Lekshe Ningbo, that the Chittamatrans still say that objects, there are external objects, but not external objects that are different entities from the mind. Okay. For all the other schools other than Chittamatra and the Yogacharasvatantrika, objects are causes of consciousness, right? Let's say an eye consciousness that perceives this mug. This mug is the cause of that consciousness, so they exist at different times. First the object, then the consciousness, the very next instant perceives that. For them, objects are a cause of consciousness in that they cause it to be produced in their image. So this object causes my consciousness to be generated in an image of this mug. Causes must exist before their effects, not simultaneously or heavens to be afterward. Causes always exist before their effects. Because nothing can affect an already existing entity in that very moment. When something is existing, nothing can affect it in that moment, only the next moment. So at the moment that we consider, let's say, the cup at moment one, or the cup at moment A, there's a consciousness also at moment A, eye consciousness. This cup can't affect this consciousness of moment A. The consciousness of moment B, or say moment two, the next instant, will be generated in the image of the cup of moment one or moment A here, right? We talked about this before, it's not different. Causes must exist before their effects, not simultaneously or afterwards, because nothing can affect nothing can affect an already existent entity in that very moment. Thus, because of the cause and effect relationship of objects and sense consciousness, and because causally related things must be different entities, okay, there's another point. What does that mean? Causally related things must be different entities. When we talk about cause and effect, say, fire is the cause of smoke, right? Are fire and smoke the same entity? They're different entities, right? They're different things. What about moment A of consciousness and moment B of consciousness? Are they the same entity? The same entity? Maybe they're different entities. They're one continuum. They form one continuum, whereas the fire and the smoke don't form a continuum. Moment A of fire is in the same continuum of moment B of fire. It has its own continuum. Mental consciousness has its own continuum, but the moments are individual entities.
But
Yeah. So Sweet Kim at 6 years old. You can understand more. You say, can you remember when you were six or three or five? We say, yeah, I remember. Are you the same now as you are then? As you were then? No. You know, you have different mind, different aspirations. You have a different body. One continuum, but we see there's some kind of different entities, right? What do you think? Sounds strange? So causes must exist before their effects, not simultaneous. Thus, because of the cause and effect relationship of object and sense consciousness, and because causally related things must be different entities, causally related, one moment of Sui Kim gives rise to the next moment of Sui Kim. Right? You're causally related, the individual moments. The mind-only oriented schools assert that object and subject are different entities. The non-chittamatra oriented schools assert that object and subject are different entities. Only the chittamatra and the yogacara svatantrika say that the consciousness and its objects are one entity, because they say for them they arise simultaneously, whereas the other schools say that's not right. So for the other schools, the Vaibhashika, the Sautrantika, the Sautrantika, Svatantrika, and the Prasangika, all of them, they say that consciousness and the objects are different entities, and they are external to the mind. The Chittamatrans disagree, saying that the Buddha taught that a sense consciousness perceives a present object. Yeah, he said. That's what they're saying. So that means the consciousness must be simultaneous with the object. They're present. It's a present object, right? Whereas if object and subject were cause and effect that were different in time, then since a cause has ceased when its effect exists, a sense consciousness would be perceiving a past object. This is the Chittamatra argument. Okay, they're saying it. The Buddha said, come on, it's like when your son or daughter says, Mom said I can have that cookie. Yeah. Trying to call the Buddha out. Since a cause has ceased when its effect exists, a sense consciousness would be perceiving a past object. But the Buddha said the consciousness perceives a present object. But all the other schools, in answer to that, the non-Chittamatra schools, say, the Chittamatrans are saying, you other schools must accept that an object of a sense consciousness exists one instant prior to its apprehender. Right? Following? The object exists one instant before the consciousness that is being generated in its image, the apprehender. But those schools, these non-Chittamatra schools, say that the object is present in the sense that there is no moment intervening between the object moment and the perceiver moment. Okay? The Chittamatrans are saying, the Buddha said a consciousness perceives the present object. They were saying that means it has to be simultaneous. But the other tenets, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, and above, say it is perceiving a present object, but what it means is there's no intervening moment between the object of, say, time one and the consciousness that arises in its image at time two, the next moment. There's no intervening moment. So it's perceiving, it's said to be a present object. So when we do when we're doing our Mahamudra meditation, meditating on the consciousness, remember I said, in one sense, you could think a corner of the mind is watching the rest of the mind, or the whole mind is being cognizant of the whole mind, but not in the sense of a self-knower. What the whole mind is being cognizant of the previous moment of mind. One moment of the little spy in the mind that's watching the mind, what's the clarity of the mind, is actually knowing the clarity of the previous moment of mind, right? Because any apprehension of the clarity of the mind is an apprehender, a consciousness, and it has to have arisen from its cause, the previous moment of its object. If its object is consciousness, so one moment of consciousness gives rise, it has its clarity, and it is that clarity is known only by a subsequent moment of the consciousness. I noticed that recently in rereading a commentary that His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave on Mahamudra, and he was pointing out that either way that you look at it, whether you think of the whole consciousness is somehow knowing the clarity of the consciousness, or if you think of just part of the consciousness is watching the clarity of the consciousness, in either case, is always knowing the clarity of the previous moment of consciousness. Chittamatra would say it's knowing the same moment, and they would say that because Chittamatra also accepts this self-knowing awareness. So they would accept that in a different way. So the Vaibhashikas or Tantrikas upper tenets say that you are perceiving a present object in the sense that there's no intervening moment. The Chittamatrans, however, are able to uphold Buddha's teaching on this point without any qualifications. They say, oh, you're making the qualification. You say there's no intervening moment, but we don't have to. We say the Buddha said what he said. He meant what he said, right? He said you're realizing a present moment without any qualification. For them, for the Chittamatra, objects and subjects exist simultaneously. A seed, Tibetans say, we say sabon, or in the word in Sanskrit is bija. Also, when we talk about mantras, we talk about like the seed syllable of Manjushri is what? D, or the seed syllable of different, Tara's seed syllable at the center of her mantra is tam. So that's also, in Sanskrit, it's also called bija. So we have in our consciousness seeds or predispositions that are activated and simultaneously produce both the object and subject that cognizes the object, much as in a dream. So this is a Chittamatra position. So they say that those two are simultaneous. When the seed or the predisposition ripens to have a perception, the perceiving consciousness and its object come from the same seed. They're simultaneous. So they say they're upholding in that way the Buddha's teaching that you perceive a present object. Make sense? For the Chittamatrans, an object is the same nature or entity as the perceiving subject, although an object is not a mind. Okay, so some subtle things here. The external, so-called external objects, the things that we think of as external objects for Chittamatra, are not external to the mind. They appear that way. That's the big illusion to them. Just as for Majjhimaka, phenomena appear to be truly existent, but they are devoid of that. For the Chittamatra, this big illusion that we have is that phenomena appear to be external to the mind, but they are not that way. Actually, very profound. You can have some very deep realization by realizing, understanding that or practicing on the basis of the Chittamatra view. You might say that's erroneous because phenomena, from the Prajñāgika point of view, are external to the mind, right? But by practicing in that way, by practicing from the Chittamatra point of view, you can make some very deep realizations, even up into the maybe the impure illusory body, even in the practice of Tantra. Or maybe from the Yogacara's Svatantrika point of view. For the Chittamatrans, an object is the same entity or same nature or entity as its perceiving subject, although an object is not a mind. So Chittamatras doesn't say that the objects, remember when the seed or predisposition ripens, one of it is subjective, one part of it gives rise to the subjective mind that's knowing a particular object. The object that it knows is not a mind. The object that it knows is not an object external entity from the mind, but we still say they are external objects because they appear to be external to the mind. If an object were a mind, it would have to be shown that it apprehends objects, and such cannot be shown. You cannot show that this cup knows objects. In this way, with object and subject the same entity, but conceptually different. That is, for the Chittamatra, the consciousness that knows the cup and the cup are one entity, but they're still conceptually differentiable, right? You can say the subjective mind and the object that it knows. So that's what's called in sort of translated nowadays, what do we call? Isolate. Have you heard that term? When Geshe-la teaches, Ken Rinpoche teaches about Prasangika point of view, we say that say an object has two natures for the upper tenets, right? Its conventional nature and its ultimate nature. Are they different entities? Pardon? They're one entity, but different isolates, like the two sides of a coin. If you cut, you could say, oh, you could cut the heads and the tails. Do you say that in Singapore? Maybe you don't have heads and tails. You know, one face, one part has a different printing on it than the other side of the coin, usually, right? So differentiable. If you cut the coin down the center with a saw, a very thin saw, you could say, oh, you could separate them, but then it's no longer a coin. You can't buy anything in the market with it anymore, right? So phenomena, from the Prasangika point of view, the conventional nature and the ultimate nature are of the same entity. They're one thing. You can't separate the two, yet still they're conceptually differentiable. They're said to be isolates. Okay? So for the Chittamatra, object and subject are the same entity but different isolates. Not synonyms. The consciousness that knows is not a synonym of the object that it knows, but they are mutually exclusive, with one never being the other. The consciousness is not the object that it perceives, yet still they're the same entity. They arise from that one seed. The Chittamatrans are able to uphold mind only and still uphold present the five aggregates, including forms. So they say there are, because the Buddha talked about the five aggregates upon which you impute the pure person and so forth. So with that, let's take a little break for lunch. A lot to chew on. Besides your lunch. So if any of you meet together for lunch, you can discuss. I think the ultimate arbiter will be Roger. If you have any questions, because he's paid very good attention to this. So let's just very quickly think. Whatever merits I have created this morning, my mind being tortured by, and having the patience to sit, to listen to this and to try to understand, I've created some imprints to make realizations in the future and maybe had some understanding. Whatever merits may it become the cause of my eventual achievement of enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Okay. So we'll meet again at 1:30, right? 12 o'clock now. Let's have a good lunch and chew on these tough bones. For my trip back on the airplane. And when I came, I got the food. It's supposed to be some basket.